I'm going to make him an offer again.
I feel the need for speed.
He's watched every movie more than once. He's Stephen Fenech.
Go ahead. Make my day.
He's watched the latest Disney movies with his kids, but that's about it. He's Trevor Long.
You talking to me?
Together, they bring you the best movies you've never seen.
I will look for you. I will find you. And I will kill you.
Rent, buy or stream the latest and greatest movies on Fetch. Watch on a big screen Hisense TV.
Say hello to my little friend!
The best movies you've never seen.
The first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club.
With Stephen Fenech and Trevor Long.
This is the captain. Brace for impact.
The best movies you've never seen. Welcome to the show. My name is Stephen Fenech. I am the, well, so-called movie nerd slash expert. and I am the host of this show. And my co-host is my colleague Trevor Long, who is slowly building his movie library week to week. And I even heard your reference to The Shawshank Redemption in your EFTM podcast.
I'm so proud.
And someone said, well, I think you mentioned, can someone tell Stephen Fenech about that?
I said it to a caller and then I immediately said, can someone please send Stephen that? And thank you
Yeah, yeah, it was great. Today, something a little different.
Okay.
We are actually talking about a documentary.
Well, it's not a movie. We can't be on the show. I'm leaving. Goodbye.
It's a movie-length documentary. Still a movie.
Right.
And I actually saw it in the theatre. Spoiler alert. I saw it in the theatre.
Movie-length documentary.
It's When We Were Kings. This was released in 1996. This is the story behind the Rumble in the Jungle. So George Foreman, who was the heavyweight champion at the time, and Muhammad Ali, who had just come back from a spell outside of boxing for reasons we'll get into.
Right.
So he's the challenger, the older challenger here, on the comeback trail. He was stripped of his title 4 years earlier because he refused to go to Vietnam, lost a court case, was stripped of his title. So there's a bit of background to this.
Yep, yep.
Now, the Leon Gast was the producer, director of this, of the documentary, and it was, they arrived in Kinshasa, which is in Zaire.
Yep.
And they arrived a few days before. The date was, the fight was scheduled for September 1974.
Yep.
So they filmed the fighters' arrival. There was a lot of musicians in town, and they filmed all their training. They did the training. Interestingly, the fight was meant to be the B-roll for the concert footage. This was all about the festival in Zaire. And the boxing was meant to be the background. I'll get into more of that in a moment. But what had happened? We find out that there's a delay because Foreman gets cut. There's a 6 week wait.
Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, after all of that's finished, Leon Gast returns to New York to start editing. He gets in touch with the production company in Zaire to try to reimburse his expenses. They've got no record of it. They're thinking, what do you mean? Turned out that that company was a shell company in the Cayman Islands. It was controlled by the Liberian finance minister. So Leon Gast wasn't getting paid. And the person who was trying to help him lost his job in a coup afterwards. So he was left with nothing. So he gets back to New York. They filed a lawsuit against the company. He gets ownership of the footage that he shot. Took 20 years to get the footage back. So this was shot in the mid-70s. Took nearly 20 years to get this to the screen. He turned up in New York in 1989 with 400 hours of film and approached David Sonnenberg to finance it. And he was, David Sonnenberg was the person who said, mate, you know what? The festival in Zaire was sort of the working title. He goes, mate, he looked at all the footage. There was 400 hours. 40 hours was just about the boxing and the fighters.
Yeah.
At the time, they couldn't use the fight footage because that's another reason why it was the focus of the boxing wasn't right. going to be there because they didn't have the rights to the fight.
Oh, of course.
Because it was pay-per-view, right?
Right.
So
yep.
it was all about this festival around the fight.
Right.
But by this time, they could get access to the footage. On top of what he shot, this producer, David Sonnenberg, says, mate, this is about – you've got some gold here, Muhammad Ali, Foreman, mm-hmm. all this stuff's gold. It's got to be about the fight.
Yeah.
And that's when he switched. He said, right, I've got to restart again.
Think it all over again.
Yeah. So
– that is wild.
Yeah. So he's –
can I just confirm?
Yeah.
Didn't take 20 years to get ownership of the – Of the
20
footage.
Years to bring
took
to 20 the screen.
Years, yeah. Just took 20 years to make it happen.
Well, he didn't get the footage till the 80s, so it was like more
literally
than 10 years.
The footage was sitting on tapes in Zaire?
Yes. It's just sitting there. He had to go through it all, and eventually he got it all together. And what they suggested, right, that it was there's a filmmaker, his name's Taylor Hackford. He's directed a few movies.
Hmm.
He was the one who suggested, let's bring in Norman Mailer, George Plimpton, Spike Lee, all bring them in to talk about it from today's perspective.
Yes, right.
Because a lot had happened. So
because it's so just to, yeah. just for context here.
Yeah.
Steven's talking about a movie that was released when?
1996.
So released in 1996. Yeah. 20 years after it happened.
Yeah.
I'm now watching
20
it.
20 plus years.
I'm now watching it 30 years later.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm looking at this through the eyes of someone who is seeing historical footage,
yeah.
and then, frankly, historical footage of people talking about historical. You know what I mean? It's like this third dimension
style.
Like I could imagine there's another addition
yeah.
to this, which is
yeah.
some of those same people, the evolutions of that. It's quite.
Maybe.
That was why I was watching this, going, I wonder now
yeah.
or stuff like that.
But when you think about it, the delay actually worked in its favor because in the meantime, Ali had retired.
Mm.
They just had the Atlanta Olympics, and he lit the torch.
He lit the torch, yeah.
And there was we knew about his condition.
He had his
issues.
Yep.
Foreman had retired by then mm-hmm. as well. So I think it worked in their favor. In fact, it was just the remarkable timing because this won the 1996 Academy Award for Best Documentary.
Oh wow!
And guess who was at the award ceremony?
Ali,
Muhammad Ali. And George Foreman. George Foreman helped
hang on,
him.
They were there to collect
they
this?
Were there
wow.
because it was nominated.
Yep.
When they won the – and I watched this on YouTube again the other day. When they won, Leon Gaston, the producer, were up on stage and one of them just mentioned, look, this is just a testament to Muhammad Ali. He got a standing ovation
wow.
and then George Foreman got up and actually brought him up to the stage as well and standing ovation were clapping for like 2 minutes straight. For Muhammad Ali, mainly for Muhammad Ali, but also for George Foreman.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So they're not clapping for his grills; they're clapping for the
exactly right. Yeah, yeah. But okay, so that's the
wow.
background.
Wow,
okay.
wow, that's a lot of that is a lot of setup.
That's
from
a
you.
Lot
yeah,
of
yeah.
setup for this movie. Now, you didn't even know this existed until I told
no
you
idea.
Last week.
No.
So your impressions before your first viewing is probably very small.
I'm coming into this with nothing. I had heard yeah. of The Rumble in the Jungle,
right.
and I would have associated that okay. with Muhammad Ali. I wouldn't have been able to put George Foreman in that.
Okay.
Because the thrill in Manila also resonates
yes,
with me. So
that was later. Yeah,
I'd heard of these things, yep. but I had no idea a movie/documentary had been made about it.
I mentioned that it won the Academy Award
yep.
for Best Documentary Feature, and they were presented the award. The two presenters were Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith.
Yeah,
Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith were co-stars in Men in Black, but Will Smith starred in a biopic about Muhammad Ali
mm-hmm.
as well. He played
that's
Ali.
Right.
He played Ali.
See, I would have thought that's the movie we would have watched.
No. It was good, not great.
Not,
good, not great.
Not a best movie,
yeah,
right?
Not wow. good, not great. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was directed by Michael Mann, too, who I love. He's
Can
a
I
great,
just ask,
great
on that
director.
Movie,
yeah.
did he play a good role?
Yeah, he did.
He
yeah,
played
he did.
A good Ali?
Not bad. Good. Got the voice down, got okay. his sort of mannerisms
yep.
down and kind of looked like him, but if I had to choose a movie about Ali to watch, it definitely would be this one, When
okay.
We Were Kings.
Right.
Righto, we're going to get right into the weeds in the Rumble in the Jungle, When We Were Kings. if you haven't seen it, you can catch it through Fetch.
You can rent. What I did was I rented it on Apple TV. Now, that, it's, to be honest, that's a complex process for a lot of people because you've got to actually do it on your phone and then it's available in your library on streaming apps and things. But see, here's the thing about streaming apps. If you want streaming, Fetch has you covered. Netflix, Disney+, Apple TV+, Prime Video, Paramount+, Stan. Not coming soon. Now. Available today. You can buy a Fetch box or get one through your internet provider like Telstra or Aussie Broadband. And you can sign up or add all those services that you already have on there. And you can sign up through Fetch as well. There's a management plan that you can tick the boxes and add these services if you don't have them already. But then there's YouTube, BritBox, HeyU, even Acorn TV, DocPlay. In fact, I wonder if this is on DocPlay. So there is a lot happening here on Fetch. It is the all-in-one entertainment box with live free-to-air TV, live subscription paid TV that's $20 a month for a bunch of channels, like 50-odd channels, all the streaming services, all the catch-up TV. What you need is there. Hook it up to your big screen TV and you've got it all on Fetch. You can read more about it, see demonstrations, look at the list of thousands of movies available, all at fetchtv.com.au.
All right, you have now watched When We Were Kings for the very first time.
Yep.
Your impressions after your first watch?
I was fascinated that the fight was such a small part of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, because it had to be really, didn't it?
It was the build-up, wasn't it?
It's all about the build-up. I was also fascinated, and now what you tell me makes sense, but it's fascinating to see, because obviously I've talked before about like 8 days a week, the Beatles doc and stuff like that, and you wonder how a documentary comes about sometimes, like how much do you have to follow someone or a person or a team or whatever to get this footage? Man, and this is going back, this is the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Actual physical film, big heavy cameras. This is not an easy thing to do. These days, you could follow someone around with an iPhone, and that fills the void of bits of the footage. But what blew me away about this was that access.
Yeah,
access was amazing to me because it didn't feel like, and obviously it wasn't. It didn't feel like it was an outsider taking a video camera. It felt like they were part of the plan from the get go, which was mind blowing to me. So the ability to have that level of access.
Yeah.
To stay on the ground, like I was blown away. They stayed in this random country
for another six weeks. Yeah,
and that's unbelievable. So yeah, that was fascinating to me.
And your social media tweet/thread/post.
My social post on this is that's a good question because I hadn't thought about it in enough detail, to be honest. But my social post on this one would be, I knew about Ali, and so do you. But the When We Were Kings gives you a story that you've probably never heard. Because I genuinely don't think people have heard of the Rumble in the Jungle. Did you know the fight was delayed by 6 weeks and they stayed there?
Yeah, that's right. No, it's incredible.
That wouldn't happen. Imagine there's this stupid fight coming up with Jake Paul and Mike Tyson. imagine that got delayed. They're not going to, if that was happening in Sydney, for example, they're not going to stay here for six weeks.
No, they're not.
They're going to fly home, keep training, then come back.
I've got more on that during the run through. But As I mentioned, I watched this at the movies.
Right.
It's the first documentary I've ever watched in a theatre. That's how big this was.
Right.
I'd never watched it in a theatre. A documentary, you normally, would you go to the cinema to watch a documentary?
No.
It's very rare. This would be a Netflix show.
Oh.
It would come straight out on Netflix and it would be number one program for that weekend.
Yeah, true.
I've seen it so many times since. And I'll tell you why I like this movie, because I love sport. Ali is just mesmerizing in this doco. He's everything he says. He's just a showman.
I agree. That's probably because we've always known that Ali is this wordsman. You know the way he razzes it up at press conferences, stuff like that. But this proved that was not an act.
No.
I think that's what this most proved to me. Yeah.
There's a lot of exclusive footage here that really it showcased his ability in and out of the ring.
100%.
And also, too, the other thing that I like about it, too, because it was at a time when there were tensions in the US sort of between the black community and society, and then we're talking about going back to Africa and sort of it had a lot of racial overtones as well.
Yeah, stuff that I hadn't understood.
Yeah, there was a lot of things.
You watch Godfather of Harlem on Stan?
Yeah.
That follows this period, and there's people referenced and photos of them in this that are referenced through the what are they called, the Brothers of Islam or whatever they're called. But like I had this scratched awareness, but it was the surface that was scratched. Yeah. You really can't imagine how deep that goes.
So the background was pretty solid, but also it had the twists and turns of a movie.
Yeah.
Like the things that happened, like the delay and then this happening and the – the upset. It makes sense
now that you say it was meant to be about the festival, not the fight, because it's very hard to make a documentary about a fight when it's just two blokes bashing each other for potentially 15 rounds and a couple of You know, it's but gym sessions beforehand.
What made it, I reckon, a successful documentary was they put the fight into great context. It was in good. Ali making a comeback. Foreman was the undisputed favourite for this.
I think that I would say this from the get-go, as a lover of sports when it's at its peak, but not a follower of Ali, for example.
Yeah.
I didn't get I probably needed to pay far more. I need to watch it again to get a true understanding of where Ali and Foreman were at in their careers. I a bit struggled with that. I couldn't work out whether Ali was at the end and Foreman was at the start.
Well, he was. Yeah, Ali was sort of coming back from his ban.
Yep.
Foreman was the reigning champion.
Yeah,
he'd beaten Joe Frazier.
Feel like this is a Netflix doco.
Yeah.
Would be. I feel like this was made.
How this isn't on Netflix right now or any streaming services, I don't know.
I feel like this is made for a boxing fan.
Yeah.
And I think a Netflix executive would have said, right, we need to. It's great, but we're just going to need to add some context here. I need a commentator just to explain this, and this.
Yeah.
And also give me a timeline, you know? Give me a career flashback and timeline. And stuff. Well, that's probably all that they
need. And they do in this. It's very good. They sort of give you a bit of mini biography, which we'll talk about in the run through. But let's talk. Well, the cast, if you can call it so, in a documentary, Muhammad Ali.
It's a solid cast. Yeah.
He was born Cassius Clay, born in 1942, became the youngest heavyweight champion at that time at age 22. You know who beat his record back in the 80s? Mike Tyson. At age 20, he became world champion. Now, Muhammad Ali had 61 fights for 56 wins, 37 by KO. He died back in 2016, age 74.
Hmm.
George Foreman, born in January 1949, so he was 7 years younger than Muhammad Ali. He fought 81 times for 76 wins and 68 by KO.
Wow.
So they're the two fighters involved. I want to mention George Plimpton, who was a sports writer. He wrote for the Paris
Review.
Which
one's he?
He was the grey-haired guy. The
English one. There was one of them was like English, George, and the other Plimpton, one was American.
The other one with the blue shirt on, that was Norman Mailer.
Right.
But
I thought they were outstanding.
They added
in this.
To it. George,
isn't it weird to talk about people in a doco as being outstanding?
George Plimpton wrote for the Paris Review. He was a sports writer, and he covered all these big events and sort of wrote it from a personal perspective. He's a really good sports writer in that regard. He died back in 2003, age 76. Now the other commentator was Norman Mailer, and he was an American novelist and sports writer.
Right.
In fact, he wrote a book which I should have brought with me. I've got it, called The Fight. About the Rumble in the Jungle.
Oh,
he's written
really?
A book. Now, he died in 2007, aged 84. But their commentary, because they were there.
Oh,
they
I'll
were
be honest
on the
with
ground.
You. I'll tell you right now.
Yeah.
They make this.
Absolutely. So there's a great combination of
mainly
their commentary.
Also because they're not the same character. Do you know what I mean? You get
They've lived on a bit after that.
You get two rugby league journos, and they're pretty much the same people. There's a couple that might stand out.
True.
But I think that this is like, you know what this is, and this is a bit inside baseball, but this would be like having Chippy and like someone completely more mainstream, whereas Chippy was this, you know, very, very unique perspective and language
God
about the
him.
World.
Yeah. He's a good man, Chippy. Righto, before we get to the run-through, let's talk about Hisense. And if you're in the market for a TV, why not go Hisense? They're Mini LED Pro, available in 65, 75-inch. They're the very popular sizes, but they feature Hisense's amazing Mini LED Pro technology. So it combines ULED technology and quantum dot to create these amazing colours, impressive contrast. So when you're watching movies like When We Were Kings, it's like you're there. It's like you're at the Rumble in the Jungle.
Ooh.
These are IMAX Enhanced certified as well. There's a fair bit of content out there that is IMAX certified. You can watch it on your Hisense TV. It has Dolby Vision IQ, HDR 10 Plus adaptive, and an anti-glare screen. We do watch our TVs in our open plan bright rooms. You're not going to get any reflections on the Hisense TV. And if you're into your gaming or sport, there are modes to support that as well. So gamers, 144Hz game mode pro, and for your sports lovers, there's 200Hz motion as well. So it's going to look pretty spectacular and also sounds good too. Multi-channel 2.1.2 surround and Dolby Atmos on board. And you've got to remember too, Hisense has a 3-year warranty on their TVs. Not many companies can say the same. They do stand by their products. So if you are in the market, and they do have sizes, all kinds of sizes, they do have their Mini LED Pro, the Mini LED X, which is their flagship, and many more coming to market in 2024. Go stand in front of a Hisense TV and see the quality for yourself.
Can I just add, Stephen, yes. You're very disappointing to me because you haven't gotten enough trouble here during this advertisement for Hisense in a very important program, because if Muhammad Ali was famous for anything, it was the way he talked and his rhyming, you know, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, all that kind of stuff.
The greatest.
Let's remember, Hisense just makes sense.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Okay. Come on. Yeah. That's... If it wasn't Gideon, it was Muhammad Ali that came up with that one, right?
Absolutely. I like where you're going with that. Check them out, hisense.com.au. Righto. Well, this is it is a first for us. This is the first documentary we've covered
on the
best movies you've never seen. And it does really get off to a flyer.
Yeah, when I get to Africa, we're going to get it on because we don't get alone. I'm going to eat him up. He's too much speed for him. Too fast. Too fast. Give me that. I'm a retired heavyweight champion of the world. I'm going to retire the heavyweight champion of the world. On September the 25th, the world will be stunned. That's right. If you think the world was surprised when Nixon resigned, wait till I kick Fulman's behind.
I love that one.
That's a good start. Mate. That is one of the best.
Really,
I don't know how
cut.
That's
yeah.
How you recover from that in terms of finding a best line.
Yeah, there's a few others, but I do like the fact that that intro, that was the very start, then it kicks into the intro of the music, and there's mixed cuts of sort of coloured people in Africa and America, sort of mistreatment, you know, people, police sort of arresting them and riots and stuff like that, sort of trying to give you a sense of it. Also looks at the dramas in the Belgian Congo, sort of riots. You hear sort of news reports in the background, army mutiny, introduced to the president of Zaire, Mobutu as well. And then we go into a mini biography of Muhammad Ali and his rise as a heavyweight through the ranks. Did you find he was such a well-spoken young guy? Did you feel that?
Like you got to give it. For a bloke's been bashed around the head from the early days, he was very articulate.
Yes, absolutely.
Which I think, frankly, apart from his glove, I think that played to his success and popularity.
But I do like this little clip where a reporter's trying to get him to stop talking.
Let me see you close your mouth and just keep it closed.
Well, you know that's impossible.
No, keep it closed.
You know that's impossible. I'm the greatest. And I'm knocking out all bones. And if you get too small, I'll knock you out.
I'm knocking out bums.
You wouldn't run. You'd run away at that point, wouldn't you? I could knock you out.
So we sort of get a sense of who he is and sort of rising up the ranks. And he's interviewed about Sonny Liston ahead of their first fight.
You'd actually take him on before the fight?
Beat him like I'm his daddy.
I saw Sonny Liston a few days ago, Cash.
Ain't he ugly?
Ain't he ugly?
That's I'm funny. Young, I'm handsome, I'm fast, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat.
So, imagine having that much of a rap on yourself.
Wow. So you know what? You know who tried to do that? Remember Anthony Mundine?
Oh, yeah, Mundine,
he tried
for sure.
to do it. Just didn't have the same sort of charm and charisma as Muhammad Ali did. Like, looking back on that, you think, this guy, what does he think? But he backed it up.
Ali didn't ever go off the rails in any way, did he? Apart from the controversy around him not enlisting.
But in terms of
controversies around him.
Well, there was controversies around his refusal to go to Vietnam.
No, I understand. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Apart from that one. Like, I'm talking, because
he joined the Nation of Islam.
He's very clear here about, you know, drugs. Like, he's actually, aside from those, which are big things, but little things, he doesn't have...
No.
Moral, like Anthony Mundine, he's not someone you would present as a role model a lot of times in his career.
Maybe not,
Sometimes you would absolutely think that he is. But, I think that's what came out to me about him was some of these lines that are recorded.
You hear him talking about, you know, advice for young kids. Yeah, stay off the dope. Wash your teeth. Remember, he says, look, you know, get off the candy and all that. Like, he's kind of a bit of a role model in that regard. So, in that sense, for sure. So we get to this. This is amazing, this little bit here, where they've announced the title fight in Zaire and Muhammad Ali is just holding court in front of the press.
Then I leave the game just like I came in, beating a big, bad monster who knocks out everybody and no one can whoop him. That's when that little Cassius Clay from Louisville, Kentucky came up and stopped Sonny Liston, the man who annihilated Floyd Patterson twice. He was going to kill me. But he hit harder than George. His reach was longer than George. He's a better boxer than George. And I'm better now than I was when you saw that 22-year-old undeveloped kid running from Sonny Liston. I'm experienced now, professional. Jaw's been broke, been knocked down a couple of times. Bad. Been chopping trees. I done something new for this fight. I done wrestled with an alligator. That's right. I have wrestled with an alligator. I done tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail.
That's a great That's one. Bad.
Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Bad dude.
Bad. Fast. Last night, I cut the light off my bedroom, hit the switch, was in the bed before the room was dark.
Incredible.
Fast.
Incredible.
And you, George Fullman, all of you chumps are gonna bow when I whoop him. All of you. I know you got him. I know you got him picked, but the man's in trouble. I'm gonna show you how great I am.
Prophetic words.
What I love about that is that also showed to me, because there's a lot of, and we've been in these situations in press conferences and things where whether it doesn't matter whether they're a CEO of a company or a sporting person, when they've been in the game long enough, they know the people in the room. So he points at a bloke and goes, "What about you? What about you?
Put your hand up. Be honest." Yeah,
and that's an acceptance. That's actually driving him. It's like, I know you all think he's going to beat me, but
that's all good. But obviously there were doubts about his chances. You mentioned that he even asked the press in that thing who they think will win. Yep. And a lot of them honestly put up their hand. They think, mate, Foreman's going to win. But at the time, one of the most famous sports presenters was a guy named Howard Cosell. And he weighs in on it too.
The time may have come to say goodbye to Muhammad Ali, because very honestly, I don't think he can beat George Foreman.
Howard Cosell, you told everybody I don't have a chance. You told them I don't have nothing but a prayer. Well, chump, all I need is a prayer, because if that prayer reached the right man, not only will George Foreman fall, but mountains will fall.
Maybe he can pull off a miracle. But against George Foreman, so young, so strong, so fearless, against George Foreman, who does away with his opponents one after another in less than 3 rounds, it's hard for me to conjure with that.
And you're always talking about Muhammad. You're not the same man you were 10 years ago. Well, I asked your wife, and she told me you're not the same man you were 2 years ago.
You couldn't get away with that
I
today.
I was thinking the exact thing oh, hang on, mate.
Like, it's a great line, and good on him, but, mate, you'd get hammered today.
Man. I love this bit where his mum, there's a little clip of his mother describing why he got into boxing. Remember, she explains the fact that someone stole his bike.
Yes.
And he was worried, went to see the policeman.
And the policeman little,
come
was the
with
one
me,
trained.
Taught him how to box. He goes, I'm going to learn how to box. If I find the girl who stole my bike, I'm going to bash him.
Policeman taught a kid how to self-defense bash a bloke.
Yeah, there you go. And now here we come to the controversy where he refused to go to Vietnam, was sentenced, and then joined the Nation of Islam for an exemption.
Yeah.
So that was kind of he was stripped of his title, and we're talking like 4 years out of, like, imagine the current world heavyweight champion now saying, mate, you can't fight anymore, and you got to step down for 4 to 5 years.
Mm.
That was what was happening right there. And he sort of polarized a few people because he's refused to go to Vietnam. I think Spike Lee, one of the commentators, says, look, I didn't do anything to these guys in Vietnam. Why should I go fight them? Why should I go kill them? They did nothing to me.
Yeah.
And so that sort of divided a few people about their opinion of him anyway.
And also, let's be real, Americans are very patriotic.
Yes.
And for, I would say, the majority are very invested and patriotic towards their armed services as well, which is a beautiful thing about them. I love the fact that they respect their armed forces. And so you bring that into wartime.
Yeah.
You find someone who's high profile and shunning it. So it would have worked badly against his reputation.
Definitely. So here we next see, and this is, I think, the first time we hear from Norman Mailer. This is Ali sort of and describing, not only he's got quite a famous sparring partner who goes on to win the world title, but just his style of sparring.
Yeah, I was struck with how well he'd actually handled Ali in their sparring session. He'd dominated Ali. That wasn't uncommon. Ali very often would not show his best stuff with his sparring partners, but in fact would work on his weaknesses. He'd go against the ropes and he'd let people pummel him. Very heavy hitters who were sort of clumsy, he'd let them bang away at him. It was as if he wanted to train his body to receive these messages of punishment and absorb them faster than other fighters could absorb them.
So that famous fighter was Larry Holmes.
Yeah.
And was his sparring partner, who went on to be the world champion.
What I wonder is, and obviously hindsight's 2020, but that quote,
yeah,
it sits with you for the, because he's preparing himself
for punishment.
And so I wonder whether that observation was made after the fact.
Yeah,
or
it
whether he wrote about that during the sparring. Because there would have been 6 weeks worth of reporting right? Even between the two fight dates.
Yep.
So I wonder whether that guy wrote about that thing before the fight.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Sparring, did he really observe that
during the
sparring?
He saw what he saw. Like he mentioned that he'd have a lot of a variety of people to spar against. Some heavy hitters, some take a pummeling. So I think in the back of his mind, I think he knew, well, Ali's style is to use the sparring sessions, as he said, to work on his weaknesses.
And
that's what he did. Yeah.
Genius,
yeah,
obviously.
Absolutely. So here we've had the fight announcement. Ali talks about the purse for the fight. So he's going to get $5 million for him and $5 million for George. That's a lot of money, for 74. That's massive money.
Yeah.
Massive money. Now, the thinking was, who the hell is going to pay for this?
The president of Zaire was willing to put $10 million of his country's own very scarce, hard-earned currency on the line, not for any short-term economic reason, but because he felt that the fight would be good in terms of promoting Zaire and also in terms of promoting himself. And as Ali said at the time, countries go to war to get their names on the map, and wars cost a lot more than $10 million.
Fair call.
It's a fair call. Like, you can't really question most of those kind of statements.
So Mobutu, he thought, that's a shrewd investment.
That
person, by the way, was Thomas Hauser, who was Muhammad Ali's biographer. He's one of the also the commentators in the film. Next, we see Don King announcing the fight and a lineup of musicians for a three-day festival. You got James Brown, B.B. King, the Spinners, the Crusaders, and many more.
So it's funny, as a younger bloke, I was absolutely aware of Don King, you know, the hair.
Yeah.
By the time I got to it was hair and it was grey at the peaks and stuff, because he must have been still massively into promoting fights when I was, you know, like, was he promoting Holyfield and Tyson or something?
Yeah.
Like those kind of fights?
This is what adds to this story, is that this is his first real big promotion.
Oh, right.
This is it. Starting out.
On the map.
So all these things happening at the same time, him organising George Foreman, him organising Ali, $5 million each, we've got to work out where it is. So, and Muhammad Ali talking about how, you know, his involvement.
And it's a big honor to be part of that too. Plus, I got to whoop George. Got to whoop George. We're going to rumble in the jungle.
Now, I think that's where they coined the phrase from, him saying it. He said that, and that's what it became known as, the rumble in the jungle. At George Foreman's press conference, he was asked a few things. He asked, I think, if it's this going to be his hardest fight. He goes, oh, it could be. But then he was told that Ali was going to donate some of his money.
Basically use his money for good.
For good. And he talked about donating his money to a hospital.
Yesterday, Ali told us that he's going to use part of his money for the building of a hospital. Do you intend yourself to use part of your money for something? Have you got a project?
He may think he may have to be in the hospital.
Is that his best line?
That was a smart reply.
He's not really an endearing character in this whole program.
Unless he's more kind of talker, isn't he? Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I think he talks with his fist, doesn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. Ali and Foreman heading to Africa. They arrive in Zaire. And immediately, this is what worked. There was a journalist who he had a translator. And he was saying that he arrived with his German shepherd. And it immediately offended Africans. Because German shepherds were used by the police as police dogs. So you're thinking he's automatically on the wrong foot with the Africans. So.
There was also a bit of a picture painted of the two of them here being very different, because it felt like George flew on pretty much a private jet, whereas Ali didn't.
Yeah.
Like it felt like they were painted as very different people in this early stage. You're trying to understand who they are.
Did you like the bit when they're flying over there and they're filming on the flight?
Yeah,
they're all singing. All black crew.
He was in the cabin.
How good are these? And he goes, look, they can speak English and French. He goes, we can hardly speak English back in America. Like, he was really praising them.
It feels weird to say those things and talk about that now because it's obvious, but, you know, it just shows that in the 70s,
at that time,
you know, people of color in America had literally had no appreciation for how, you know, their their kind in Africa yeah. were simply running the joint.
Absolutely.
They didn't realize.
And you got to remember, so while we're talking about mainly the boxing part of it, interspersed in this movie are scenes of the musicians organizing themselves.
It didn't make any sense to me, to be honest, because I got the sense, I understood from that last press conference that there was going to be a music concert.
Yeah.
I recognized James Brown.
Yeah. B.B. King. Yeah.
I didn't recognize B.B. King, I know which one he was in it now that I think about it. But it was really just there to break up the movie. I didn't get a sense of this festival. I didn't get a sense of anything about of the scale of that.
Yeah.
It was just well done to make you go, okay, we're going to transition here to a different part of the documentary.
What tied it together? There were scenes of them talking about, you know, the blacks and racial tensions and various things, and how they were sort of saying we organised this. Wasn't a coloured thing. Yes, Don King organised this thing. So there was that sort of flavour in the air as well.
Fair.
Also, at that time, they were showing scenes of Zaire. So people, workers in the field, generally poor population.
Yeah.
And then the musicians arriving for this festival. George Plimpton weighs in too, talks about the location of the fight and the timing.
Well, of course, the fight was held in Zaire, and the former Belgian Congo. Kinshasa was the capital on the banks of the Congo. It was just before the rainy season when this fight took place. Off to the north, you could see the flickering of storms and coming closer and closer. But it was very important to the promoters of the fight that this fight get in before the storms occurred, because once the rainy season comes, you can't do anything.
That's important.
Which is a really important thing to put in.
Now, Norman Mailer, Mobutu, talks about him and what he did there was quite a high crime rate in Kinshasa at the time, and Mobutu came in and put the broom through the joint.
Before the fight came, the criminal rate in Zaire began to go up, and a few white foreigners had been killed driving their cars. And Mobutu decided that this was going to be a disaster in terms of publicity. So on a given day, he had 1,000 of the leading criminals in Kinshasa rounded up and put in this stadium down in the detention pens. And then and I suspect the legend may even be true, that he had 100 of them taken at random and killed them. And the reason was a particularly simple one from a Buddhist point of view. Criminals who make a life out of it have connections that protect them when they're in trouble. And by making this kill of 100 out of 1,000 arbitrarily, what Mobutu was saying is your connections are worth nothing.
Boom.
Wow.
So we see Ali and Foreman.
It's one
now.
Way to clean up the crime rate, by the way.
It is a bit, yeah. We see the two fighters, Ali and Foreman, training.
And they're training in the same place.
Yeah, after the other.
Yeah.
So I think, and the first
was
person.
Was there only one gym?
Well, I'm not sure. They had a facility worked out for them. I think there was like security issues and stuff. They wanted to keep him secure.
Fair call,
But also, I think George Foreman trained first, and he made
this one where
he
has an impact on the heavy bag.
Heavy use of the heavy bag.
It seems to me that of all the people I've seen hitting heavy bags, including Sonny Liston, no one ever hit it the way Foreman did. At the end of 15 minutes of pounding the heavy bag, there'd be a hole in the heavy bag, not a hole, but a huge dent the size of half a small watermelon in that tremendous heavy bag, and Foreman used to use the biggest heavy bag around. What would be interesting is Ali, who would train after Foreman, would often pass by this large hall where the training took place, and he never looked at Foreman hitting the heavy bag. He just walked right by as if Foreman did not exist.
See, now what I love about this as a documentary is the fact that you've got that piece of audio, right, from an observer, from a journalist, right, and you're able to match it with footage that you've got because you've got so much footage. I feel like my thought is that is exactly what happened. This bloke happened to say that and they found footage
to match it.
Whereas I feel like today you watch a lot of docos, people are shown a bit of footage and then they're asked to respond.
Yeah, maybe.
Whereas this feels super genuine. It feels like that's like a genuine assessment and really cool, really well done.
Mailer describes Ali starting, so you're talking about he's going to dance and the the move to take on Foreman. While Foreman, he talks about his tactic was what he called cutting off the ring.
Yeah, yeah. I thought, as soon as he said that, I understood what he meant. It's like, you know, the ring is four corners.
Yeah.
Make one of the corners all he can use and just move left and right, essentially, to stop him getting out of that corner.
So the combination of them watching Foreman just make mincemeat of the heavy bag, cutting off the ring. He said all the riders saw this and they were pretty pessimistic about Ali's chances.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. All these riders and observers are watching everything.
Absolutely.
They're watching all of these
things happen.
And that's why they're aware what happens next. They're there and
this is the twist, this spar. If this is a movie, if this was a fictitious movie, you'd throw this twist in. And the twist is that Foreman suffers a cut. So he was sparring. I think his opponent put his elbows up and he's walked into an elbow, cut himself above the eye. So training mishap. Cuts his eye. So they're thinking, oh my God, what the hell are we going to do? Apparently, Mobutu didn't let them leave.
I was wondering, you're stuck here. I don't think that's clear in the movie that they were not given a choice.
Well, for things you don't know, I've got a bit more detail about it. But bottom line, they weren't allowed to leave. And there was even a question a reporter asked. He goes, they're not going home. They're going to delay it. Are they allowed to go home? And there was that concern. So they had to delay the fight 6 weeks.
What?
So Foreman's trainer, Dick Sadler, said in a good part of the documentary, he goes, look, I haven't made a decision. I don't know what we're going to do. So do we wait here 6 weeks? Do we go home? What are we going to do? Ali, on the other hand, was starting to talk about some options.
Initially, Muhammad went through a pretty bad couple of hours, and he first wanted to move the whole fight back to the United States. And when he was told that wouldn't work, he said, well, then let's bring Joe Frazier over here, and I'll fight him again. And instead of each of us getting $5 million, I'll take $3 million, and Joe can take $1 million. But after a while, he calmed down and he realized that there was nothing that could be done about it except stay in Zaire an extra 6 weeks and make the best of it.
Now I gotta wait. He's gonna get his whooping, but I just have to wait.
Do you remember that was in his training?
It's a good line.
Yeah.
He's gonna get his whooping, but I just have to wait.
He kept it up, didn't he? What he was saying, his predictions. But I like this bit where Ali kind of wins over the crowd. He sort of
Ali, Mumbai.
So he sort of he has won them over.
The man's in trouble. The man is scared. He's in my country to start with. It's in my country. You want to see? Want me to show you he's in my country? Ali Bumuye. Ali
Bumuye.
Ali Bumuye. Can you pitch 100,000? Can you pitch 100,000?
How do you see it? Ali Bumuye. Ali Bumuye. Ali.
Boy, when I hear them brothers hollering like that, whoo, I'm going to get my soul and my spirit. 100,000 African brothers hollering Ali Bumaye. And I'm tired. I just can't take it no more. Let me get out of here.
So Don
it was a good
King,
strategy, though, to really just own the crowd.
And he uses it in the fight. Don King, meanwhile, he knew his reputation was on the line.
Right.
This was a big thing for him. It had to work. This was his introduction to the world.
Yeah, because he's a former criminal. He'd been in jail.
Yes.
He doesn't have a reputation as a stand-up businessman.
That's right.
This is a big deal for him.
But he was taking the setback in his stride, but, you know, still determined to press on.
He's really quite a remarkable man. Don King is one of the brightest people I've ever met. He's one of the most charismatic people I've ever met. He's one of the hardest working people I've ever met. He is also totally amoral, and I can't think of a man who has done more to demoralize fighters, exploit from fighters, and ruin fighters' careers than Don King. But you have to give him his due for what he did to make Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman and Zaire.
That's a wild little grab, right?
Yes.
It's huge.
But that's told
bouquets.
In retrospect. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But still, it's a, you know, it's a huge bouquet of praise.
And buckets.
Then
dumped
on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, that's not an unusual thing to have a figure who is polarizing like that, but still unbelievably, in some ways, brilliant and successful.
When you think of sort of the heyday, the glory days of boxing from this period all the way through the 80s and, you know, Tyson, Holyfield, mate, he was at the center of it. Yeah. He was the guy who promoted it to that kind of level.
Yeah.
Ali's there. So there's a bit here talking about, you know, wanting to inspire black people back in America. Foreman sort of more or less sort of not as colourful as Ali, but sort of expressing the similar sentiment.
And I realize how unfortunate and how uncomfortable it is for some of you guys to travel so far and expecting so much and getting so little.
George Foreman was a phenomenon. He was almost like a physical guru. He almost never said anything, but when he did, it was arresting. You never quite knew what he was talking about. It might be deep. It might be non-responsive. He was negritude. He was this huge black force.
Because of this, I had expected Muhammad Ali to be here today. I was going to immediately jump and hit him in his mouth to give you some form of entertainment.
But see, he says, you've come a long way and all that. Man, I just can't get my head around the like a journalist ringing your editor going, man, I'm stuck in Zaire for 6 weeks.
Yeah, see in 6 weeks.
Like, who's paying for this? Like, there's so many questions that are broadly unnecessary because they're just a nerd like me. But honestly, I want to dig into the weeds on this one.
It was a different time. Yeah. It was, well, I think they're on assignment. Well, you think about it. It actually made it a better story that they're stuck in Zaire. It made it a great story.
And you could imagine, though, and I think the two that they do speak to throughout it seem to have a close relationship in the after fact with the fighters. Because, mate, you see, like, if you go to Bunnies training every day and report only on the Bunnies, you're going to get to know the players and you're going to build a rapport, even form friendships, right?
Yep.
6 weeks on the – probably 8 weeks because they were there beforehand, but a long time on the ground with the team, with the trainers, the everyone involved,
they get pretty close to them.
You become – they're great stories, you great learnings. It would be amazing.
Well, Norman Mailer wrote a book. Highly recommend it. It's a brilliant book. Here's an interesting little part where George Plimpton describes meeting witch doctors and soothsayers, and interesting little thing he mentions here.
I was very interested in people called féticheurs. They are witches, soothsayers. And in Western Africa, almost everybody has one. It's like a witch doctor, and you go to the doctor the way we would go to a dentist. Muhammad Ali had been to Mobutu's féticheur, and he had said that the féticheur had said that a woman with trembling hands would somehow get to Foreman. A succubus. And that impressed me enormously.
So just keep that in your eye. His later commentary kind of qualifies this.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I don't see how it comes together.
But Ali was told, he goes, that a woman with a trembling hand is going to do something and that's going to affect George Foreman.
Yeah.
Right. Just adds a bit of colour to the story.
Yeah.
All right, we've arrived at fight night, and it was fun. Did you realize the fight was held at 4 a.m.?
When they said that, I thought, my God, this is Formula One style stuff. They're putting it on. It's like the Olympics, you know. The swimming is put on whether it's daytime or nighttime. Yep. The finals are on based on when it will – so it drops in prime time in America. Well, that's how it works.
Let's use Sydney as the concept here. Sydney as the example. Sydney Olympics, the finals were held at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
They were during the day.
So that they would be nighttime in America.
So it's 4 a.m. fight here to make it a more suitable time. For American audiences. Now, Mailer and Plimpton, they observed the Ali camp before the fight, and they really didn't give him much hope.
Yep.
Ali's dressing room was like a morgue. It was like the Last Supper. And at a certain point, Ali said, "Why is everyone so unhappy? What is the matter with all of you?"
The sense was that we were watching a man who was going out to the gallows.
Because they all believed that he was going to get defeated, and they were terrified. They thought that with his pride, he would take one of the world's worst beatings ever, and he wouldn't give up. And he was going to be destroyed in that ring, killed or maimed or they knew not what. But they were deeply frightened now. It was as if they were taking whatever fear Ali might have had before this enormous confrontation, and they were absorbing it.
So after a while, he looked at Bodini and said, "We're going to dance tonight, aren't we? We're going to dance."
And they said, "You're going to dance." He said, "I'm going to dance."
Muhammad Ali was so funny, gracious, repeating this.
What am I going to do? And they said, you're going to dance. He said, yes, I'm going to dance and dance. And that man is going to be bewildered. I'm going to dance and dance. And they said, you're going to dance. And I swear they were all crying. And he built them up to a degree so that for him they became half happy.
Which is, you know, wild that the fighter has to build up the team to get his own support. Like, that's the last thing you want to do. Mate. You want to be supported and pumped up. That's that's the whole job. They've literally failed him on the last day.
Yeah.
Well, 6 weeks they've been there and they failed him.
Naylor nailed it. He goes, they were worried that his pride was going to get him killed. Like, he's going to get a beating. And we also observed, like, Ali, Foreman come into the ring to start the fight. Mobutu, nowhere to be seen.
Brushed.
Wasn't at the fight. Norman Mailer claims he was always afraid of being assassinated, so he thought he'd be a nice target at this title fight. And Mailer described the atmosphere. He said it was intense. Fighters in the center of the ring, and you notice in the clips here, Ali just constantly
never
talking,
shuts up,
talking to George, and George Foreman just staring him down, not saying a word.
Yeah,
very intense. Anyway, round one, Ali comes out aggressive. Not staying away. He's lands some punches, including a few right-hand leads.
A right-hand lead, which means that you throw your right without countering. You throw it first. You throw it like a jab, but you throw it like there. That has to travel that extra distance across the shoulders. Professionals will very rarely use a right-hand lead because it's a terribly dangerous punch to throw since you are open to a counter with a left hook. And fighters, since they work in milliseconds, can see a right coming much faster than a jab. Nobody had thrown a right-hand lead at Foreman in 2 years. And in training camp, none of his sparring partners for $50 a day was going to start throwing right-hand leads at him because it's a great insult to a top professional when you throw a right-hand lead at him. It suggests that he's slow enough that you can hit him with it. And instead, Ali figured out the one punch Foreman's not prepared for is a right-hand lead. He's expecting me to dance.
Yeah.
I'm not going to dance. I'm going to hit him with right hand. I'm going to knock him out in the first round. Ali threw 12 right-hand leads. I don't think he had told anyone he was going to do it. I think he may have debated about whether he was going to do it up to the last moment. And the only thing is he didn't knock Foreman down and he didn't knock him out. Instead, Foreman went crazy.
And you're at that point thinking, okay, this is not good, because he obviously thought that was going to get him through the fight. He thought that was going to be his way of winning.
That was his tactic.
So, again, in terms of a documentary, that's a beautifully placed grab that allows you to be brought to a point of believing Ali's about to lose.
But also, too, it educates you, too. Like, I never knew before I watched that. I had no idea what a right-hand lead
was. And it was a lot of detail. And it was talking about the timing and
coming across your body, and it was an insult to a fighter to even throw that. So that combination of the right-hand leads actually landing, but also the fact that he did it, it just enraged George Foreman. So Ali
went back
to his corner.
Which is the last thing you want if you haven't knocked him out.
Absolutely
I would assume.
Ali's gone back to his corner, and this description of he's had this absolute look of fear on his face.
Ali went back to the corner. He finally, the nightmare he'd been awaiting in the ring had finally come to visit him. He was in the ring with a man he could not dominate, who was stronger than him, who was not afraid of him, who was going to try to knock him out, and who punched harder than Ali could punch. And this man was determined and unstoppable. And Ali had a look on his face that I'll never forget. It's the only time I ever saw fear in Ali's eyes.
But what does Ali do? Turns to the crowd and says,
"Fire me up.
Ali,
Bumbaye,
Ali, Bumbaye." And the crowd responds.
Mate, imagine being George Foreman and having thousands of people cheering against you.
But then
in a neutral venue.
The fight continues.
Foreman, like everyone else, had assumed that Ali would dance. And so Ali now went to the ropes and went into the rope-a-dope. And a lot of people thought at that moment the fight was over, especially on television where they saw it, because it looked like Foreman was now killing a very weak Ali.
Now, you don't go to the ropes. And there he was, leaning way back. I wrote about it as if, I think the phrase I used was, it was like a man leaning out a window is trying to see if there's something on his roof.
Great line.
You know, taking up, but you couldn't really see then. Here were these great broadsides going at him, and it looked as though he was being set up for the kill. And it happened so quickly and so abruptly that I shouted to Norman, the fix is in. You know, that somehow he's supposed to go down in the first or the second. Ropes is halfway house to the floor. It just looked as though he had to cave in.
So for the next three rounds, he went to the ropes. He lay on the ropes.
I was already at this point thinking, okay, hang on a minute. Because of that earlier mention of him taking the beatings against the ropes, in the guts and all that kind of stuff.
During his sparring.
As a first-time viewer and someone who has no idea the outcome of this fight, to be clear, I look at this and go, he's just trying to tire him out.
Yeah. So you had no idea that you didn't know who won this fight.
No idea.
You didn't remember.
No, mate.
Oh, you hadn't.
Man,
right.
Why would I even know?
I think that's even better. I'm envious.
I'm jealous of
you not knowing that.
I'm watching this like it's live. I'm going, come on.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's amazing. But I love the fact that when he was like he was copping Foreman's blows. Mm. But did you see?
He's still whispering in his ear.
He was still talking to him. He was still whispering sweet nothings.
He'd go all the way back. He'd slide out. He'd come in and out of it like that. And occasionally he'd get hit. And he'd say, George, you disappoint me. You don't hit as hard as I thought you would. George, you're not hitting hard enough. You're not breaking popcorn, George. You're just not hitting. And Foreman's insane with rage. And whanging at him and whanging at him and whanging at him. Powerful, powerful, powerful. And middle of the fifth round, Foreman was worn out. He had punched himself out, taken three rounds.
So we're now into the fifth round.
Yep.
Ali has come back off the ropes.
Suddenly Muhammad Ali came off the ropes and he hit him a right. And you could see the sweat just pour off, just like a fountain come off Foreman's face. And you suddenly realized there was some design in this madness. You know, I then turned to Norman, I remember, and I see he must have been somewhat puzzled, but I said, the succubus has got him. Referring back to this woman with the trembling hands that I've been told by the witch doctors were going to touch Foreman and destroy him.
Now, maybe this could be the tactic of Ali to let the man punch himself out. 30 seconds left in round 8. Very even fight. Ali, a sneaky right hand. Another sneaky right hand. This time he works over the shoulder.
So he knocked
him,
George Foreman, out. And did you notice there was this brilliant photo?
Mate, not only was there a photo, they then matched it with the following vision, which you could then see.
Yeah.
So you saw the photo of those two journos. And
just their mouths just opening
so
in astonishment.
Good, so good. And then they show the clip of it and you can see them in the background of that. Like it's
unbelievable,
really well
mate.
Matched.
Unbelievable.
He did it. He's champion again. We couldn't believe it. It was such a classic performance and so beautiful that at the moment Ali hit the knockout punch, Foreman began to go. Ali followed him around. And Ali had his right cocked for one more punch, but he never threw it. Mm. It was, he didn't want to ruin the aesthetic of this man going down with a clumsy punch on the way down.
Unbelievable.
And you know what? Again, you'll never know what was in Ali's head at that moment. Yeah. But that description of him holding the punch because he
didn't
want
to spoil the moment.
It would look useless if he punched him while he's on his way down. Yeah. Is
that's referred
poetic.
To in popular culture. I've heard that referred to. I remember Aaron Sorkin in The West Wing, I think someone said, it's why Ali never threw the punch and let Foreman fall.
Yeah,
I've
right.
heard it referred to in culture. That he didn't throw that last punch and just let him hit the ground. Now, interestingly, the minute the fight finished, the monsoons came. How's that for timing? Yeah. And they were saying that the dressing rooms were 3 feet deep underwater. That's right after the fight. Now, Ali said apparently after that he wasn't going to fight again, but apparently he went on to fight 22 more fights.
Wow.
And those are the fights where they claimed that he, in inverted commas, hurt himself.
There's a tendency to look at Muhammad and say, you know, he's wounded, he's ill. There are no intellectual deficits. It's a motor skills problem. And he doesn't try to hide his condition. He goes out and lets the whole world see it. He doesn't feel sorry for himself. And there's really no reason for anybody else to feel sorry for him. He loves being Muhammad Ali. He truly believes that he's doing God's work, and he's as happy with each day as anybody I know.
Hmm. He created a real legacy, didn't he?
Yeah.
And I love the next bit. The next bit's a montage of his life and career, played to the song When We Were Kings, which is amazing. And there's great shots of him throughout his career, shots of him with the Beatles and Michael Jackson and just what a figure he was. And then the very last part, and this is brilliant, where Plimpton recalls Ali speaking to a group of Harvard students.
And he had these little cards in front of me. He gave this wonderful speech about he hadn't had the opportunity, but they had, and they should use that language, that learning that they had, to go out and do their best to change the world, to make it a better place. And it was moving, and it was funny at the same time, and a great roar of appreciation at the end of it. And then someone shouted out, "Give us a poem!" And everybody quieted down. Now, the shortest poem in the English language, according to Bartlett's quotations, is called On the Antiquity of Microbes. And the poem is Adam Haddam. It's pretty short. But Muhammad Ali's poem was Me Hui. Two words. I wrote Bartlett's quotations and I said, look here, that's shorter than Adam Haddam. You want to put it in? And it stands for something more than the poem itself. Me Hui. What a fighter he was. And what a man.
Just amazing.
Yeah.
So, like, there could have been 500 favourite lines in this one, but I've managed to get three out here. This is a funny one where he's talking about Howard Cosell.
I'm going to let everybody know that that thing you got on your head is a phony and it comes from a tail of a pony.
Remember, he was well known for having this wig.
That's good.
Now, this is a really interesting one. He's describing the punch he threw to win a title and how quick it was.
By the time that thing hit four, that's how quick, from the time the punch started to the where it landed, it was 4/100ths of a second, which is an eye blink, like a camera flash. That's 400 a second. Now, the minute I hit Sonny Liston, all of those people blinked at that moment. That's why they didn't see the problem.
And this last one, this is Norman Mailer. This little encounter he had, which just typifies Muhammad Ali.
He said, oh, I hope I'm as young as you are when you were 62. You are looking wonderful. He went on and on like that. And the moment I was gone, he turned to my wife, who's much younger than I am, and he looked at her hard, and he said, you still with that old man? And for me, that's always been, that's Ali.
Yeah, mate.
It's good.
Incredible. All right, some things you might not know. No real plot holes in this one to talk about, being a documentary and all. In 1997, so a year after he won the Oscar, Leon Gast spoke on the Charlie Rose program.
Right.
And about what made Muhammad Ali different. And I'll read what he said. During the filming of it, he was the most generous, accessible human being I've ever worked with.
Wow.
On other projects I've worked with some icons in the past, and usually the closer I got to them, the more that icon would begin to tarnish and disintegrate. Wow. But with Ali, it was directly the opposite. The closer I got to him and the real story of Ali, he just became this individual who I think one day will be probably remembered as much for his actions outside the ring as inside the ring.
That's a big call.
That's
because,
huge.
You know, they always say don't never meet your heroes.
Yeah.
And it's true
they
of a lot.
You.
It's true
right.
of a lot of
yeah.
people, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think Ali always had a reputation of being good and great and lovely to people, but it's very different when you spend that
yeah.
much time with them and for that still
he
to
did.
Be the case.
Yeah, he was with him for weeks.
He would have
yeah.
seen the best and worst of him.
Absolutely right. Now, remember I told you the fight was postponed for 6 weeks?
Yep.
Apparently, Mobutu ordered both fighters and their entourages to remain in Zaire during the time to ensure that the fight still takes place.
Right. Given he killed some crimson cages, probably
that's right.
just to stay there, yeah.
Now, do you remember the concert, right?
Yeah.
The concert still had to go on
the normal
in September,
time.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it turned out that the ticket pricing was high because it was aimed at, like, it's like, you know, I went to Vegas to watch Souths play, right?
Yeah.
Imagine if the Souths were some delay and you're in Vegas, you think, well, I'm not going to go to Vegas now. They've postponed it. So they were anticipating foreigners to go to watch the fight that were going to buy tickets for the
right.
music festival
concert.
As well. There was no fight. There was just the music. So empty seats, it left. It was pretty much a disaster, the whole thing.
Oh.
Yeah, like with the ticket prices was on the like $100 at the time, expensive. That's what a Zairean would earn in a year. So they're not going to the concert. Yeah. The show did continue, though, and right. Gast filmed it. Leon Gast filmed it, and many of those performers still gave great performances. But as I mentioned, empty seats. It was a bit embarrassing, the whole thing. Now, When We Were Kings is regarded as one of the best boxing documentaries ever made.
Right.
It maintains, and I checked this the other day, a 98% positive rating at Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
Which is massive. I have one, did you notice?
Okay.
George Plimpton has been in a movie we've covered.
What?
He was in Good Will Hunting.
Really?
Do you remember when they were going around to different psychiatrists?
Yes.
And he was talking to Will, and in that scene he was asking him, okay, tell me more. And Will Hunting says to him, he goes, what do you mean? He goes, I don't care if you putt from the rough. He accused him of being gay.
Hmm.
And that's him. That was George Plimpton in that scene. Yeah, he's done some acting, and that was one of the roles.
Yeah. There you go.
Righto. Three questions for Trev.
Okay.
Did you know all of that before watching
No.
it?
No. Absolutely. Had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. No. So that was it was a twist ending for you, wasn't it?
It was like watching KO Sports, to be honest.
I watched it live.
Yeah, live documentary it was for me.
You're only 40 years too late.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
50 years too
late.
What
year was it?
1974.
Yeah, it was before I was born.
Yeah, there you have it. So 50 years ago it was. Yeah. Wow. 50th anniversary of the Rumble and Jug will be in October.
Wow.
Wow. Should have timed this for then.
I was going to say.
Timed it for then. Were you a boxing fan before watching this?
No.
Were you
not
much of a boxing
fan? Just because I produce radio sports shows,
right.
I was aware. Like I was on air when Holyfield Tyson earbite stuff happened. Yeah.
Ah, okay, right. Mm. Question three. This movie make you want to visit Africa one day?
No, did not. No. My views on visiting those kind of countries has not changed.
All righty. Now, give us your wrap-up and your rating.
I enjoyed it because it was eye-opening, right?
Okay.
It was I learned. I discovered a lot. But it didn't.
Yeah.
It hasn't jumped out at me as being – I'm nervous now because you are so passionately in love with this.
I love this movie.
And Stephen – so before we recorded, Stephen said, I've already got my rating. I've written it down. It's in my script so that you know that I'm not trying to match you. There's no way you're going to come near me.
Right.
Because this is at best a 7 for me.
Okay.
At best.
Right. So you weren't really taken by the whole drama of it?
I think it's
amazing.
I think it's a great Netflix show.
The shock of it all.
Like, honestly, I don't know how this works in the cinemas. This is a great Netflix show.
Right. Okay. It did win the Oscar for Best Documentary.
Well that's great, mate.
So you can see my rating is right.
Stephen's rating is 10. I knew you were going to say 10.
It's a 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of my few 10s, and this is, I reckon, just a brilliant snapshot of a time.
Is it because of – so this is the thing.
Yeah.
And I think this is the problem with this documentary is it because of what they had access to and what they delivered?
Yeah.
Is it because of the story of Ali –
it's all of that.
Oh,
Norman Mailer. Norman Mailer's just a great – I could listen to him talk for an hour, Norman Mailer. George Plimpton, really insightful and just great turn of phrase. And the whole package was really well, smartly put together.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry.
So what's your number?
Seven.
Okay. I gave it a 10. That's all good. Not too far apart. Anyway, should we talk about next week? Next week, this is another hidden – from my hidden gem category.
Oh, really? Okay.
The movie's called U-571.
Mate. Oh, no.
You know this. It's a submarine movie.
It's a German sub, isn't
it? Matthew McConaughey.
Is there like an Enigma code or something to crack in
maybe,
it?
Maybe, yeah, maybe. So you've heard of this.
I may have seen this. There's no way I remember what happens, but.
Well, stars Matthew McConaughey.
Really?
Directed by Jonathan Mostow. Now, Jonathan Mostow has directed a movie not too long ago that we covered. Wonder if you can remember which one. So which of these movies, directed by Jonathan Mostow, have we already done on the show?
Jonathan Mostow.
Mostow. A, Breakdown. B, Interstellar. C, Crimson Tide. Or D, Outbreak.
Mate, you're putting Crimson Tide in there just to throw me. So I'm going to dismiss that.
All right. Because that's a submarine movie too.
I reckon
A, Breakdown. Correct. Breakdown was with Kurt Russell. Remember Kurt Russell?
Pure guess, just to be clear.
Oh, well, you got it
just
right,
to be
mate.
Clear, pure
you got
guess.
The cash. You got the cash. All right. Well, that was When We Were Kings, our very first documentary, and probably our last, to be honest. But I think something different, don't you reckon? It had everything a movie offered. Great,
no,
great cast.
No, I think that's
twist.
The context that I'm probably not putting myself into is when you look at this as a script, and a production.
Yeah, you couldn't have written this.
It's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah. Amazing.
I'm not changing my views.
I'm glad you think so. So you're not going to give it more than a 7?
No.
All right. I feel gypped. But anyway, that's all good. Thank you, Trev. We'll talk to you next week.
See ya.